You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending October 30th, and it's podcast number 63. I'm Joe Elia. This time out, we talk with Dr. Christophe Carrel about the alarming cardiometabolic effects of second-generation antipsychotic drugs in youngsters. First, this review of the week's principal clinical news stories. It looks like lifestyle interventions can have long-lasting effects in preventing the development of diabetes. In a Lancet study of 2,800 adults at high risk, those randomized to either lifestyle intervention or metformin had, at 3 years, a lower incidence of diabetes relative to those randomized to placebo. At 10 years, the incidence was reduced by a third in the lifestyle group and by about a fifth with metformin. Next, antibiotic prophylaxis seems to modestly lower the risks for urinary tract infections in predisposed kids. In 600 children randomized to low-dose trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, or placebo, the treatment group had a 13% incidence of UTI versus 19% in controls. One commentator on the New England Journal of Medicine study says the more important question is whether prophylaxis will preserve long-term renal function in children with reflux. Finally, it looks like some of us aren't getting enough sleep. The Centers for Disease Control says about 10% of U.S. adults are reporting not getting enough sleep in each of the preceding 30 days. Rates were higher in some areas of the country than others. The Commonwealth of Virginia, for instance, seems especially deprived, reporting a 30-day sleep insufficiency rate of almost 20%. Not surprisingly, those unable to work and the unemployed were at increased risk. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. JAMA last week presented an investigation into the cardiometabolic risks in young people taking second-generation antipsychotic drugs. The drugs under study were aripiprazole, marketed as Abilify, olanzapine, sold as Zyprexa, quetiapine, trade name Seroquel, and risperidone, sold as Risperidal. The researchers followed about 250 treatment-naive patients for about 3 months. The patients were between ages 4 and 20. The main outcome measure was weight gain, and there was a lot of it. Adverse changes in lipids were a secondary outcome measure, and there was plenty of that too. And there's plenty to say about the implications of all this. And we've invited the study's lead author, Dr. Christophe Carrel, to talk with us. Dr. Carrel directs the Adverse Events Assessment and Prevention Unit at the Zucker Hillside Hospital in Glen Oaks, New York. He's also an associate professor of psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Carrel.
Thank you for having me.
Did your study find what you set out to find, or were there surprises?
Well, first of all, when we designed the study in 2001, basically there was very little known about the cardiometabolic side effects, weight gain, and metabolic abnormalities in children. But the first reports had come out that these medications, the newer, the second-generation antipsychotics, were associated with quite a bit of weight gain and also potentially with some problems with glucose and lipid metabolism. So when we studied children and adolescents, we designed a cohort study that had very little exclusion criteria, very few exclusion criteria, in order to really see what is the magnitude and the frequency of these side effects, but also what are the potential predictors, both clinical and biological. And when we started seeing these patients, we also saw that there was more weight gain than we expected, and that that seemed to have been mostly the case in those patients who were treatment naive. So basically, what we published in JAMA was the cohort of the antipsychotic naive first-time users. And there were a couple of surprises. First of all, there was more weight gain than was previously described, and it was more rapid in the first 3 months of treatment.
That weight gain was over the course of 3 months. It was over the course of, say, a summer or a season. And in some patients, it was up to about, the average was about, may have been 20 pounds in some, it was almost 20 pounds in some drugs.
With Zyprexa, the mean weight gain was 19 pounds, mm-hmm. and with the others, it was between 9 and 11 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, in terms of people gaining more than 7% of their body weight, which is considered a threshold of real concern, basically between 1 out of 2 patients with Seroquel, Risperdal, and Abilify, and 8 out of 10 on Zyprexa gained that amount in just a mean of 11 weeks. But the second surprise was, in addition to that, that basically all medicines were implicated in the severe weight gain, including aripiprazole or Abilify, which is usually considered weight neutral, at least looking at chronically treated adults or even in more chronically treated youth. That was a surprise here and seems to suggest that at least in the beginning, all of these patients had a serious effect on food intake, weight gain, and potentially also metabolic abnormalities. We included a small comparison group of patients who were prescribed these medications but basically refused or stopped early on. And to this group, there was actually no weight gain. It was basically less than 0.5 pound over 3 months, suggesting that basically this weight gain is not just due to the new onset of an illness or related hospitalization, which had been a discussion point or the point of debate, thinking, well, is it really the medication or could it be that the underlying illness that starts could do some of the weight gain?
These drugs can be life-saving in some children. On the other hand, if they're prescribed so widely and with such profound metabolic effects, then are we starting to verge toward a hazard here?
Well, this is an important question and consideration, and as you indicate in the beginning of your question, it has to really be weighed between the risks of illness and the risks and the benefits of the medication. Antipsychotics are usually prescribed for severely ill patients, traditionally for psychotics or psychotic adults, where we don't have really any other medication class to deal with psychosis. But with the advent of the newer second-generation antipsychotics that have less neuromotor side effects and have also shown to have broader efficacy spectrum, medications are used also for severe mood disorders, among them bipolar 1 disorder, and severe aggressive spectrum disorders. This new indication group has increased the use of antipsychotics in children and adolescents. And we have to just pause for a second and imagine these kids are brought by psychiatrists because they can't function anymore. They can't go to school. They can't be social with their peers. They don't function at home. And remember, when kids can't go to school or can't develop along their usual milestones and fulfill their trajectory, that's a serious situation. People, kids, when they stagnate, actually don't just stagnate. They fall back behind their peers. So it's just important, as you say, it can be life-saving. It is also saving that future by adding these symptoms that debilitate these kids. However, on the other side, we have to then look at what do these medications do? Are they always necessary? There are lower risk alternatives. And what are the real risks of these medications? So the study published in JAMA suggests that at least looking at the patients that did not have prior weight gain and didn't have prior treatments, so in the naive patients, we see that all of these medications can cause weight gain. Weight gain is much feared because it's been associated in the general population with things that portend poor cardiometabolic outcomes like stroke, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and a heart attack. But the second surprise in our study was, although the weight gain was steep and fast, ranging between 8 and 15% on average of their baseline body weight over 11 weeks, the metabolic signature of these medications, the metabolic effects, differed drastically. So Zyprexa, which was associated with the greatest weight gain and also changes in waist circumference and changes in body fat, was associated with pervasive effects metabolically. That included fasting glucose, insulin resistance, and all lipid parameters except for the protective HDL cholesterol, which is much more associated with exercise change. Mm-hmm. The second in line was Seroquel. Seroquel and Risperdal and aripiprazole, Abilify, had a similar change in weight, roughly, but Seroquel caused the most lipid abnormalities across almost all categories. Then third in line was risperidone, which had a very confined adverse effect of significantly increasing triglycerides, which are associated also with insulin resistance. And then the surprise was that aripiprazole, Abilify, which had similar body composition changes that were negative and was an increase in these risk factors, did not cause any metabolic malady in the sense that parameters changed significantly from baseline over 11 weeks, and was actually similar to our control group that was off antipsychotics. That suggests that in addition to the weight-related indirect effects of medications on metabolic abnormalities that are related to through weight, so the weight-dependent indirect effects. That in addition to that, these patients also have a direct weight-independent effect, and that seems to be strongest with Zyprexa, second with Seroquel, and almost absent, countering the weight gain for Abilify. Now, the problem is obviously that this is just a follow-up for the first 11 weeks. We followed these kids for as long as they were on the medication, and we're still in the process of collecting more data because in antipsychotic-naive patients, there's a lot of switching going on. Patients are not improving enough. They have side effects. So it's hard to actually get a large cohort of patients who are followed for up to 1 year. But we're conducting the study right now to see, are there different trajectories of the weight gain and the metabolic abnormalities? When does it level off with medication? And when is a threshold reached that the weight gain then turns into metabolic abnormalities? And for all medications, we found very little effect in new development of diabetes and metabolic syndrome over the first 3 months. But the fear is obviously that with the magnitude of the weight gain, these metabolic problems can emerge earlier in their lifetime.
So these measures are pointing toward that danger, and you won't really be able to know whether in fact that came to pass for another 10 or 15 years. Is that right?
Well, that's the question. How long it will actually take. We hope that it would be 10 or 15 or 25 or 30. But the fear is that with this drastic increase in weight and fat mass, abdominal adiposity, that actually there could be an even greater acceleration of that, and patients would have some of these negative cardiovascular outcomes even earlier. So we hope that over our one-year study, we can look already at secondary measures that could be intermediary outcomes, like diabetes, like metabolic syndrome. But it may take decades for the negative effects to occur. We have some information on that from adults. We know that adults with mental disorders who are generally more obese than the general population have higher rates of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, die on average in the United States 25 years prematurely compared to the general population. And that's mostly conferred by cardiovascular illness. So we are afraid that the earlier weight gain occurs, the earlier the metabolic changes occur, the more this will potentially shorten people's lives.
So what should clinicians be doing with this information, say, this week? Would you advise that they consider using some of the traditional agents, or would you suggest that they monitor more carefully those cardiometabolic measures that you did in your study?
So I think there are four things to consider for clinicians based on our results and the studies that have been done so far. First one is you need to really think twice and carefully who requires these medications. So it has to be a careful indication around the use of this medication, mm-hmm. class. Do patients need it? Can we use medications or non-medication interventions that have lower risk and could also improve patients' outcome. You mentioned particularly first-generation antipsychotics. I do not think, based on the current data, we did not include a first-generation antipsychotic, but based on the current data, that molendone or pirfenazine or haloperidol are metabolically safer than Abilify. The data suggests that they are basically on par, that they are similar when it comes to antipsychotic naive states. Even first-generation antipsychotics can cause a lot of weight gain.
Okay.
So basically, we're not saving metabolically anything there, but we have higher risk of extrapyramidal side effects, maybe relapse, and also tardive dyskinesia and treatment discontinuation.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest to use a lower risk. First, you have the right indication. Then you choose a lower risk medication. I would still suggest that our aripiprazole, Abilify, and ziprasidone, Geodone, which we did not have enough antipsychotic patients in our study for, are still considered the lower risk agents.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's a lot of weight gain in the beginning, the weight gain trajectory seems to level off much earlier than with the other agents, because in chronically treated patients, actually Abilify and Geodon both do not have much weight gain, and that extends to children and adolescents who are within 1 or 2 years of their treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is we need to educate and monitor patients and families. That means that patients and families need to know that with the start of these medications, appetite can go up, weight gain can increase, there's a lot of food intake, so they need to know what is a good diet, what are healthy lifestyle behaviors that they need to either adopt or even intensify, because what they've done so far is not enough anymore when they're confronted with these medications. So the first one was indication, second one was choice of the lowest risk agent, third is monitoring, but fourth one is then if these adverse events occur and we monitor them, then we need to do something about it, switch to a lower-risk agent, or at least pair up with an endocrinologist, pediatrician, somebody who can help treat some of these abnormalities.
Okay.
Now, in our paper, based on the serious cardiometabolic effects, we suggest monitoring in kids should be more frequent than in adults. In adults, the suggestion is you take weight at every visit, and yes, in kids you should measure height and weight at every visit, but then the fasting blood work for glucose and lipids in adults is scheduled at baseline 3 months and annually, and we suggest that it should be baseline 3 months and then every 6 months thereafter in order to really make sure that we're capturing the true risk and can do something about it.
All right, Dr. Carell, that's very good advice, and we look forward to hearing your follow-up studies on these drugs. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me and for showing this interest in the psychiatric and medical health of our children.
That's all for this week. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374, or you can write to me, J-E-L-I-A at JWATCH. That's JWATCH.org. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Thanks for listening.